Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the environment, about what we know, about how the new Bush administration is thinking about environmental issues, and one in particular, that is logging and old-growth forests, but we may well get into some other issues as well. Our guest for this hour is Martha Marks. She is president of an organization called Republicans for Environmental Protection. Now, I know that perhaps some people might be a little skeptical about a group of Republicans who say that they are environmentalists. She, I think, would be the first to admit that the record of the party recently on the environment hasn't been what she would like it to be. However, she also reminds us that there is a long commitment in the GOP to environmental issues going all the way back to Theodore Roosevelt. And she says that's something she'd like to see the party stay with and build on. Let me just tell you a little bit about her. Martha Marks was a Spanish teacher in high school for a number of years. Then she went back to school, got a PhD in Spanish literature and linguistics at Northwestern, and then she taught college for 11 years. After that, she left teaching to write textbooks and has published six of them, and also to work as a freelance language proficiency tester and trainer for the American Council on the Teaching of Foreign Languages. In 1990, she got involved in politics because of some local land use issues. In 92, she was elected to the Lake County, Illinois Board and Forest Preserve Board on a pro-environment platform. The year after that, she helped form the Lake County Conservation Alliance, which is an organization of grassroots groups interested in preserving the natural beauty in that area. She's since been reelected two times as a county commissioner, winning 70% of the vote on her 1998 Republican primary, and then she was unopposed in the general election that fall. In 1995, she was one of a group of Republican environmentalists who were interested in reestablishing the importance of environmental issues in the GOP, and she created this organization, Republicans for Environmental Protection. She has been involved in that for a long time and continues to be the president of the organization. And as I mentioned, was one of a number of Republicans openly critical of President Bush's choice of Gail Norton to be Secretary of the Interior. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, people want to call, that's welcome. All we ask of people is they just try to be brief. We can keep things moving along and get in as many people as we possibly can. Ms. Marks, hello.
Yes, hello. Good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'm not exactly sure where to start. Maybe in a general sense. Among the things that I read was that you had written and delivered was a speech from a few years back that had to do with the Republicans and the environment. This was a speech from 1997, a speech that you gave in Indianapolis.
Right.
And what you talked about, the at that time, the more recent environmental record of the GOP, and saying that, you know, sometimes within the party say, well, if people somehow think that we're not committed to the environment, it's either the Democrats' fault because they're talking us down, or it's the media because they're talking us down. I think the thing that comes through very strongly in this speech is your feeling that, no, it's not the media, it's not the Democrats, it's your own party.
Yeah, it's us. I think I said in that speech, it's not them making us look bad, it's us making us look bad. It's the things that many times our Republican elected officials and party leaders, it's the things that they say about the environment, and I gave some quotes in that speech. It's the bills they propose, and it's the votes they take. And I would have to say that, you know, 3.5 years later, that's still very much the case. We are our own worst enemy in the Republican Party on the environment.
Mm-hmm.
We're, of course, our organization is trying to make the party better. We say we're trying to green up the GOP, and we're having some success, although it's a long project. It's a long-term, difficult uphill battle, but we think the rank-and-file Republican voters are with us on that issue, and the evidence is pretty clear that they are.
Well, I think you certainly try to remind people that there has been this commitment to conservation that as I said, indeed goes back to Theodore Roosevelt, and I think
actually beyond that.
You're quite right. Back, that's one of the guys you think about as being
right.
a big time conservationist.
Right.
And then also, it was indeed under a Republican administration, and that of Richard Nixon, that the EPA mm-hmm. was created. So it's certainly one can point to examples of Republicans being concerned about the environment. However, it seems that more recently, the commitment hasn't been there. And in fact, I got a question from somebody, an off-the-air question, making these very points and raising this very question. How is it that perhaps not just for voters who would identify themselves as Republicans, but for people who are active in the party, who are elected officials, how is it that you think that you could wake them up and communicate to them just how important an issue this is?
Well, in fact, the Republican pollsters are doing that for us. We really don't even have to do that. And I think a lot of elected officials in our party are aware that the Republican Party has a big problem, a big image problem, and a big basic ground-level problem when it comes to environmental protection issues and however you define those, whether it's clean air, clean water, or natural resources in our public lands or endangered species, whatever. The public is telling Republican pollsters the same things that we are, which is that they support strong environmental protection initiatives. They don't want protections for endangered species cut. They don't want public lands given away or sold off, as is often proposed in extreme right-wing Republican circles. They don't want the protection of our air and our water. They don't want the standards lowered for those. The Republican pollsters, all of 1995, quite honestly, have been telling the Republican Party that their own voters either don't trust the Republican Party to do the right thing on the environment, or that they don't appreciate or don't approve of what is perceived as anti-environmental positions. And I think a lot of rank-and-file voters feel that they don't have, Republican voters feel that they don't have any alternative if they are supportive of other things that the Republican Party stands for, which is, you know, smaller government and individual initiative and strong defense and good fiscal responsibility. They very often won't vote the environment at the very top of their agenda, so they vote for the Republican Party anyway, which has given the GOP a certain leave to ignore the issue. And what we've done as an organization what we are doing and continue to do is to pull together individuals who care about all those other things that the Republican Party stands for and cares about, but also cares about environmental protection and is trying to raise the issue within our party, speaking up as Republicans who care about these issues and saying, you know, you're great on other things, but on this one issue, we don't agree with what you're doing, with your approach to environmental protection. And we are growing and making some significant waves within the Republican Party. They definitely are hearing from us, and in certain areas, they're hearing from a lot of us. In certain areas, we're not as strong, but we are growing across the country. We have members in 48 states. Certain areas have quite a large membership base, and so those elected officials are definitely hearing from us. But they will be hearing more and more in the future. That's what we're trying to do, is to create a grassroots groundswell within the Republican Party for stronger environmental protection initiatives within the GOP.
Given the fact that, as you would say, that there is this within the Republican Party, there is a strong conservation mm-hmm. tradition, mm-hmm. and that we don't have to go back very far before we see, as I said, environmental legislation and Richard Nixon. We have one of the important leaders in the party in the post-war era, Barry Goldwater. I think
he was a rep member, by the way.
He indeed was a member of your organization. Uh-huh. I had the reputation. I guess my question is, what is it? Do you think that has if that is an important tradition in the party, what is it that has led the party away from that? I mean, why is it that at least in some people's minds, other things like, for example, wanting to get rid of government regulations, having very strong feelings about the idea of private property and what people's rights are, mm-hmm. belief in the unfettered market, all of those things seem to have come to the front and have eclipsed the issue of conservation?
Well, I think you've actually identified quite a few. There's There have been several strains running through the Republican Party for several decades. They all sort of came to the fore around 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, and they've been growing in strength ever since. And if we can point to a few of them, the old classic line, follow the money, is certainly one. Environmental groups give, and environmentalists, individual people who share conservation concerns, are not noted for giving large amounts of money to candidates for office, whereas extractive industries, developers, the various different special interests that depend on friendly government, and like to use public lands, for example, in the extractive industries, those industries contribute heavily to elected officials at all levels, but especially at the federal level, where it takes so much money to run. And I think they have turned the heads of a lot of people who might otherwise have a little more of a conservation ethic. Other things that you mentioned certainly play a role. The desire to have fewer government regulations is one that runs deep and true in the Republican Party, and there's nothing exactly wrong with that. We are saying, you know, we don't want more and more and more regulations, but we do want there to be a minimum floor of protection for our water and our air. And that there should be, you know, those standards should be good ones. They should be clearly enforced and consistently enforced. But there necessarily doesn't need to be a great rollback of protection. Let's just enforce them fairly. The property rights movement is something of a Western phenomenon. People who live in the East are more aware that, you know, we are all in this together and we all have a common stake in what happens on our land, around our homes, and there's more of a sense of buy-in to the idea of community. I think, and I've told other interviewers this, I think that the idea of property rights that's so strong in the West is a residual holdover of the old West mentality, where, you know, a man had a horse and a gun, and he was and his property, and he was the lord of his of everything he surveyed. And that strain of thinking is still very prevalent in the West, where they view any attempt at protection of endangered species, which is the main issue out there, as a threat to their personal property. And, of course, the takings issues, which are hotly debated within the Republican Party and elsewhere, have mostly come out of the West. So I think if you combine the money that is now involved in politics and the sort of libertarian strain of, you know, don't put any rules on me, everybody should be able to do just as they want, and the Western mentality of, you know, the man on the horse with the gun protecting his land, I think you can see where the Republican Party has developed this attitude that it has right now.
Yeah. I was certainly struck by one of the things, one of the points that you just made, and it was one of the points that you made in this speech that I referred to going back. This was in 1997, so apparently you've been felt this way for some time.
I have.
When you look at the, when you list these points, what could the Republican Party do to repair its anti-environmental image? You, the number one thing on your list, and this was, in, as I say again, it's in 1997, was campaign finance reform.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and that goes to the money issue right there.
Yeah.
And it's probably not a surprise that the champion of campaign finance reform within the Republican Party is John McCain. Well, it's not, that's not a surprise. That's an obvious fact. It's not a surprise that last year in the Republican primaries, after doing some fairly in-depth analyses of the various Republican candidates for the presidency, including George W. Bush, who basically had nothing to say about the environment at any stage of the campaign. But our political organization, Republicans for Environmental Protection, did endorse John McCain in the Republican primaries, before the primaries. We were actively involved, our members across the country in several key states were actively involved in working for Senator McCain. And it was in part because of his belief in campaign finance reform, but also because he did, of all the Republican candidates for president, he did have the strongest environmental record. Proven environmental record. It wasn't that he was, as I said in one interview, he was not an environmental saint, but he had worked very hard for some wilderness bills in the West, Arizona wilderness bills. He had worked hard to protect the Grand Canyon from tourist plane overflights, a number of things that were really demonstrably protective of the environment he had a good record on, whereas none of the other Republican candidates did, and in fact, most of them wouldn't even address the issues. So it's pleasing to us to see that the guy that we felt was the strongest Republican presidential candidate is also the one who's working the hardest and has for a long time worked the hardest on campaign finance reform. Hmm. And even though it's not a direct environmental issue, it certainly has ramifications for not only the environment, but a lot of just good government issues.
Well, we've been talking for a bit here, and I have a couple of callers, and I promise them we'll get right to them. But I think perhaps for other bit of benefit of anyone who has just tuned in, maybe I'd better introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Martha Marks. She is a president. She's president of an organization called REP America, and that stands for Republicans for Environmental Protection. It's a group that she helped to create in 1995. She was elected president in 96, an office that she still holds. She has been an elected official. She was served on the Lake County, Illinois Board and also Forest Preserve Board. Her academic background, going back some ways, is in Spanish literature and linguistics. She is a graduate of Northwestern, where she got a PhD. She taught college. After that, went into college textbook writing and publishing. And after that was when she got involved in local politics. She lives in Riverwoods, is that right?
That's right.
Riverwoods, Illinois, in Lake County, which is a far north suburb of Chicago. She's talking with us by telephone. Mm-hmm. And the questions, welcome, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana folks. We do also have, though, a toll-free line. No matter where you're listening, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we have a couple of local folks here. We'll start in Urbana with line one. Hello.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay, well, I agree with you about John McCain. I thought he would make a really good president. He had a little fire in his belly.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like you to talk about is the North Alaska coast, mm-hmm. and the oil companies all want to get up there and dig up the coast, and they don't even know how much oil is there, and it seems to me it's mostly Republicans that want to do that. So can you discuss that? It's a wildlife haven as is, but and that would be destroyed.
May I take that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have to say, ma'am, I agree with you, and our organization, Rep America, Republicans for Environmental Protection, has for the last year been doing everything we could to argue against the oil drilling and exploration for oil and gas in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And I can tell you some of the reasons that you will agree with, but some of the other people out there in the audience may not know. That is the last 5% of the Arctic coastal plain that has not already been explored for oil and gas. The other 95% is all gone. So we have been arguing.
It's all gone. You mean the oil and gas?
Oil? No, I mean that it has been explored. It has been ruined as an ecological area.
Uh-huh.
And the one of our arguments, as recently as just a month ago, during the Gail Norton appointment as Interior Secretary, we have been arguing against her appointment in part because she so strongly supports the exploration of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The arguments are always made. Well, we have to have balance, and the environmentalists don't want any balance, so we have to have balance. What we have been saying is the balance was lost long ago. We're talking about the last 5% of the Arctic coastal plain that's still a pristine wildlife area. Balance was lost, you know, a decade ago, two decades ago when they were exploring before. And so we are strongly opposed to any further exploration of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or any further exploration of the coast that would ruin the Arctic Refuge. In fact, we have put out a very nicely done action alert on that. If you go onto our website, you can read our positions opposing the exploration of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. They're pretty clear going back a whole year since we started working on this. This was, in fact, an issue that we tried to raise in the Republican primaries, and it didn't resonate very well.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, right now, we have I've been saying that the stars have kind of come together for the oil and gas industry in that there is we now have a very oil-friendly Republican administration.
Yeah.
We have a supposed energy crisis, which...
Well, don't you think all this, the increase in the gas prices, just putting pressure on the market to open up the Alaska coast?
I personally agree with that. I think I'm very suspicious of the timing.
Mm-hmm, me too.
I know that the whole thing is coming to a head in the next 4 months. I expect that the Arctic Refuge will either be opened up in the next 4 months or it will be saved again until the next alleged crisis comes along. You probably know, maybe other people out in the audience know, that the oil industry and gas industry have been trying to get into the Arctic National Refuge for decades. They have repeatedly tried. They have argued the same things before, that we had to have this oil and gas, that there was this crisis, that the American people just were being deprived of some great treasure that we had some right to have. They've been making those arguments for 20, 30, 40 years. I'm not even sure when it began, but for certainly 20 years and longer back before that. And repeatedly the Congress or the President, and sometimes both and sometimes one or the other, has said no, that we weren't going to go in there. That some places are just so special that they need to be kept.
How many people are in your organization?
A couple thousand, a little over that. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. We're in 48 states.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a force to rival the Sierra Club, and we're not something that's going to make the extractive industries quake in their boots. But the Republican Party is very aware of us.
I would think that
they're very aware of us, and I would ask you, if you know anybody who might be a good candidate for rep membership, to tell them about us. And anybody who's listening, if you want to find out more about us, we do have a website. It's actually very easy to find. It's www.rep.org. REP.org for Republicans for Environmental Protection.
Okay. One more thing. It seems to me that we need to be looking for alternative fuel, such as ethanol.
That's right. Well, alternative fuels, alternative technologies.
Yes, technologies too.
Conservation. I've heard that they've already started conserving so much in California that they've conserved enough to provide power for 1 million homes.
Mm.
What worries me is that in the great push to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, that the idea of conservation and alternative fuel development and alternative technologies are being lost in the administration. And something else that people don't realize, I don't think, that even if we were to trash the Arctic National Wildlife for its oil and petroleum, or for its oil and gas, and even if we went into all the other publicly protected, federally protected public lands that we still have only about 3% of the world's oil in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we are still going to be dependent
mm-hmm.
on foreign oil and gas suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
Oil suppliers, we will still be dependent because we can't begin to supply our own needs.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we are somehow going to become energy efficient if we will just get into those publicly preserved lands is nonsense. And also the arguments about how much oil is actually available in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge range from very low to very high, and the industry that wants to extract it is the one that's saying it's very high.
Mm-hmm. Right, of course.
Right. And the fact of the matter is that it will take 7 to 10 years, even if the oil is there, it will take 7 to 10 years to begin to get it out. So that will do absolutely nothing to help our current energy crisis, if in fact there is one.
Right.
And I'm like you, I'm highly suspicious of the timing of this.
Of the increase in prices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the supposed crisis. So.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. According to some figures that I've seen, the U.S. Geological Survey,
mm-hmm.
Their estimate is something like 3.2 billion barrels of oil that it would make sense, economically speaking, to try to get, which is about 6 months' worth at the rate that we use it. Do you think that's a
Those are the most credible
figure?
Figures that I've heard. I've seen industry figures of anywhere from 11 billion barrels to 19 billion barrels. Nobody credible has ever said that. But the industry dangles those numbers out there and acts like there's some treasure trove there that will keep us energy independent for decades. It's just not so.
Hmm.
I mean, it would take 7 to 10 years to get at whatever's there, and the best estimates are what you pointed to. That's about a 6 month supply. And some of us are arguing that there are some things that we could just conserve our way to 6 month supply. It'd be a whole lot better for the country. We don't have to go in and trash some of our last remaining pristine areas. That's the last 5% of the Arctic coastline. We're not talking about the whole area.
Yeah.
And it should be preserved.
This has come up in the past. This is not the first time people have talked about drilling there. And I think that environmentalists have been able to rally some support for not doing that. It seems to be the kind of place that really can capture people's imagination. I guess, though, I wonder whether there are other places where the issue is maybe as critical, but there's not as much discussion. For example, I have read some about the Jack Morrow Hills in Wyoming, which is a place that for a long time they have said, no, you can't go explore for energy there. Some people apparently think there's significant natural gas there. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that what I read is one of those that people say, look, watch here what the administration does. And this is going to tell you something about what their attitude is going to be.
Another area that they keep talking about is the eastern front of the Rockies up through Montana, which may be the same area you're talking about. I have heard about the Jack Morrow Hills. I'm not sure exactly where they are. But what President Bush said in his campaign and what Gail Norton has repeated with enthusiasm is that they want to open up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other currently protected areas. And what we have asked in an open letter to President Bush, which is in our latest newsletter, which we call The Green Elephant, and it's also available right at the front of our website. You can find it very easily. What we have asked is, what exactly do you mean by other currently protected areas? How far does that go? Do you mean our national parks? Do you mean all of our other national wildlife refuges? What are these other currently protected areas that you two want to open up? And we've been raising these questions, and I think local communities will put the pressure on their own elected officials to protect them. The problem for the Arctic is that Alaska is almost totally dependent on oil revenue. Alaska residents pay no income taxes. They, in fact, get, I think, a $2,000 rebate per person from the oil and gas revenues that the state has. They are almost dependent on those revenues. Their two senators, and their one representative are rabidly in support of opening up the wildlife refuge for oil and gas exploration. And you now have a president, vice president, interior secretary, and others in the administration who are also supportive of the same thing. And the problem for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is that it is remote. Not many people live there. Not many people go there. Some of us believe that just because something is not readily accessible by man, that doesn't necessarily mean that we have a right to go in and trash it.
Well, that's what makes this more difficult is that, at least in some places, there will be local people, local government officials, who will argue that it's to their economic benefit for these places to be developed. Just for example, here going back to this place in Wyoming, here an article that I read quotes the president of the Rock Springs, Wyoming National Bank, who also happens to be the local Cattlemen's Association head, a fellow named John Hay, who says that he says to lock up the land and have it for the sake of saying it's out there doesn't make a lot of sense to me. He goes on and says, we have a change, though, in administrations, and my guess is that we'll have some rational people who see that there is room for multiple use. So here, I guess you're running up against local people who are going to say, well, you know, look, I mean, it's swell to have this have pristine land, but here we are, and it's our local resource, and we want to use it because it'll create jobs, it'll bring money into the economy, and you know, I mean, how do you argue with that?
Well, you argue very well that that's not their land; that is our land. We here in Illinois, people on the East Coast, and people in the South and the Northeast, we are the owners of that federal land. It is not the local property or the special property of the local people. It is our land. We are paying to protect it. We are paying to manage it. It belongs to all of us. We are the stakeholders. We have a right to say what happens on that federal land, not just the local people. And I'd also point out, I did see that quote that you just read. He was a banker and also the head of the local Cattlemen's Association.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anybody who knows what happens in the ranching industry, the cattlemen are some of the biggest users of the public lands in the West, and frankly, some of the greatest corporate welfare that takes place in this country is done by the cattle industry. We have millions of acres that are owned by the American public, and some of it is, you know, preserved as national parks and wildlife refuges, but a lot of it is Bureau of Land Management lands, which are basically lands that have no special characteristics other than they are useful to some industry or somebody. The cattle industry is a major user of our public lands, and they are subsidized on those lands. One thing that I've learned in the recent years is that I don't know anything about ranching, but I know that there's something called an animal unit, which consists of, say, a cow and a calf. The ranchers who need land to graze their cattle pay a certain amount of money, which is around $9, as I understand, $9 a month, I believe, for an animal unit, a cow and a calf, on privately owned land, if they go into someone else's land to graze. But when it's on publicly owned land, on federal land that we own, there's a subsidy of about 50%. So the American people are subsidizing the cattle grazing on the lands that we own. And the cattle industry, of which this gentleman is a part, is already benefiting greatly by the fact that there are public lands there available to them at half the price. And what people don't always realize is that there is great environmental damage done by the cattle that graze in many cases along the rivers, the riparian corridors that used to be fine bird habitat, that used to be high-quality wetlands and protection for water quality. Those lands are all trampled down by the cattle that use them. They turn into nothing but mud puddles. They're totally lost as any other use, which is, you know, keeping water clean and providing habitat for species that might not have any other place to go. And we are subsidizing, the cattle industry is being subsidized by the American taxpayer, not only for their use, but also for the environmental destruction that comes along with it. So people like that who say, well, we've got to have public use of all of our lands, we ought to have them all opened up for multiple use, in a sense are saying we'd like to have the right to destroy all of the land that the American people own, not just the parts that we already have access to.
We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that in Clinton, Indiana. It's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know if your guest is aware of or heard anything about this gas, natural gas and oil off the coast in the Gulf of Mexico. And they said there's, you know, bountiful supplies or, excuse me, and that was about, you know, a year or two ago I heard that, and evidently nobody's done anything about it, you know, especially with this energy crisis. I just wonder if she knows anything about that.
Well, I do know that
I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thanks.
We've been drilling for years off the Gulf Coast. If you go along the Florida and Texas coast, you see massive oil derricks, so I'm not sure if you're talking about that area or if you're talking along the Florida coast. It's very interesting because the governor of Florida, who just happens to be the brother of the president, recently wrote a letter to the energy secretary, the energy department, saying keep your hands off the Florida coast if you go exploring for oil, and of course they will, but I'm not sure exactly which oil areas he's talking about along the Gulf Coast.
The I mentioned, and you mentioned that you were among a group of Republicans that had a problem with the selection of Gail Norton to be Secretary of the Interior. And I'm interested in maybe what you think about also the other posts that have important environmental responsibilities. Interestingly enough, all three of these are now occupied by women, agriculture and EPA.
All right.
What do you think about Secretary Veneman and Governor Whitman at EPA?
Well, I'll be very honest. I've never heard of Ann Veneman until she was nominated for agriculture secretary, and I don't know much about her. I do know that she comes out of a Farm Bureau background, which makes sense for agriculture. So from an environmental perspective, that does send up some red flags because the American Farm Bureau is one of the most openly anti-environmental organizations anywhere. And so naturally that is something that makes me concerned. But as far as her personally, I don't know anything about her. I hadn't heard about her before she was appointed. Christy Whitman, Governor Whitman, is We're guardedly optimistic about that appointment. We think that she has done some things very well in New Jersey. She's known across the country, in fact, for having aggressively promoted open space protection in New Jersey while she was the governor there, which is a good thing. We are strongly in support of that. Unfortunately, that's not what the head of the EPA does. EPA is not involved in open space protection. That's the Interior Department. And Gail Norton, of course, is not supportive of public open space and has had made her career on that. But Ms. Whitman has a good record on that, very aggressively attempted to acquire open space and protect farm areas in New Jersey. Her record on environmental protection there is not quite as confidence-inspiring, but she's in a different role now. When she took over as the governor of New Jersey, she did slice the state's environmental protection department radically. And in fact, it was much noted in the news at the time that she was cutting the budget by, half or more. And I think she has had some successes in the areas along the coastal areas of New Jersey in restoring water quality in some of the estuaries and the fisheries areas. What I've heard is that the rivers and the streams in New Jersey have not done as well under her term. And, of course, New Jersey's air is notoriously not good, and I don't believe it's made any improvements under Governor Whitman. So we would say that's a mixed bag, but compared to the appointment of Gail Norton, Chrissy Whitman was a bright light.
Hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, maybe a little bit more. Our guest for this hour of the show is Martha Marks. She is president of REP America. That stands for Republicans for Environmental Protection. This was an organization that she helped to start in 1995. She's also a Republican elected official. Back in the early 90s, she got involved in local government because of a land use battle in northern Illinois where she lives. She was elected to the Lake County Board. This is Lake County, Illinois, and also the Forest Preserve Board. The year after that, she helped form the Lake County Conservation Alliance and has been active on these issues. And as we mentioned, she was one of a group of Republicans who publicly came forward and said they weren't real happy with President Bush's choice of Gail Norton to be Secretary of the Interior. Did the White House take any notice of you when you did that? Or did that register on their radar screen?
Well, I believe it did. Even in the hearings, our opposition to Gail Norton was noted, and people saw one of the senators who was questioning her asked what she thought of the fact that we had opposing her nomination, and her response was basically to say, well, that they hadn't supported George W. Bush in the primaries either, so it didn't really matter. And that's true. We did not support him. But we would like very much to see our Republican president and a Republican administration do the right thing on the environment. And we have repeatedly reached out to the Bush administration during the primaries. We reached out after the primaries. We reached out before he was elected. We said we can help you find good Republican reasons to support conservation initiatives. We can help you address these issues in ways that Republicans can support, because we are Republicans and we have researched these issues, and we do believe that there are good conservative Republican reasons why the United States should continue to progress on conservation, environmental protection concerns. We never received any response. We do believe that they know about us. We have had some behind-the-scenes information coming back to us that they really wish we would sit down and shut up. And, of course, our whole purpose is to try to make our party better on the environment. We do not seek to harm a Republican president. We just want to encourage him to do better. And we have had some successes at some local and state levels. A number of our members are getting elected. And we're in the pipeline. One of our members in Connecticut was just elected to Congress last fall, the first member elected to Congress, and he is, I think, the first of several that are coming through. We have state senators and representatives around the country who are rep members, and we've had some of our members elected to city councils and county boards around the country. So we're in the pipeline, but we're still a very young and a very small organization. We will be here for a long time. If people want to find out about us, I'd love to tell them again.
Ma'am. Sure. Oh, yeah.
We have a website which can give you about as much information as anything you would ask. It's www.rep.org. You're welcome to give me a call. Our office is 847-940-0320. We publish a newsletter that's called The Green Elephant. It's a quarterly. It's quite well regarded. It goes out to about 10,000 addresses every month, every quarter rather, and we get fantastic feedback. It's people say, "My gosh, I never heard of a group like this. This is wonderful." And I'd be very happy to send a copy of that and our brochure to anybody who is interested. 847-940-0320.
We have a couple of callers here who want to get in. We'll go next to someone in Champaign.
Okay.
Line one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Hello, Mrs. Marks.
Yes, hi.
How are you this afternoon?
Well, I'm just fine.
How big would you say your constituency for Rep America is?
Well, we don't know that. We think it's certainly somewhere between where it currently is and the Sierra Club, which is much larger than what we will ever be.
Are you represented in all 50 states?
We are in 48 states.
48 states.
We're 48 states. We have no current members in, let me see if I can remember. We have no current members in Vermont and North Dakota.
Oh, nice.
And Vermont is a strange one because it is actually quite a green state.
It's an incredibly green state.
A very small state, too. And it's also, I think, a fairly strong Democratic state. But
as interest groups go, and everybody has an interest group that ever sets foot inside Congress that
sure.
is a congressman.
Sure. They're
all interest groups from the National Association of Manufacturers right down to the Sierra Club.
Right.
But in the process of trying to identify Republican candidates
mm-hmm.
that have a consciousness towards, you know, being green and not faking it.
Right.
Do you... suggest sometimes to your constituency then that in the case of two-year elections, four-year elections,
mm-hmm.
that to be as pragmatic as possible, if a Republican candidate does not have the ability to regard the environment as something worth saving, worth protecting,
mm-hmm.
do you allow them or do you suggest to them to be as pragmatic as possible in the election process? Because sometimes it takes coalition building, alliances with others that may not share all your beliefs.
Well, we are, I'll tell you what we do. We do have, let me just explain, Rep America, REP America is our membership organization. Republicans for Environmental Protection is our what we call our political committee. And Republicans for Environmental Protection does do endorsements, as for the last two election cycles. And we've had some successes there. I will mention one example up in my congressional district, which was Congressman Porter, John Porter, who was a good moderate centrist pragmatist, got top ratings from the Concord Coalition, which is for tax utilization, very very conservative on that. He also got very good ratings from the environmental organizations. When he retired last year, there was a massive 11 candidate race up here in the primary, very expensive primary. We stepped into that and did survey all the candidates, got responses from about half of them. And from the ones that responded, we decided to endorse Mark Kirk, who just happened to be the one who actually won the primary. And he won it because he was able to pull together a fairly large coalition of different interests that supported him. But he won it with very little money compared to some of the other candidates up here. We have done things like that in several races around the country where we try to help the voters, and in this case, the voters up in Lake County and northern Cook County are the Republican voters are pretty much like I am, and they're pretty much like John Porter was. They want somebody who's fiscally responsible. They want somebody who's a good moderate on social issues, and that includes the environment. So what we were able to do was to help people like that, the voters like that, cut through the gobbledygook of the primary, which was very strange on all sides. I mean, there were more candidates than you can imagine on every kind of issue when you got 11 people running. We helped them cut through that and got helped to get Mark Kirk nominated. And then, of course, in the general election, the Sierra Club came out and endorsed the Democrat in the race. And we were there with our endorsement of Mark Kirk. And even though Republicans for Environmental Protection wouldn't endorse a Democrat, just the fact that we had endorsed him, the people around here, we have a fairly large membership in his district. People know that we're credible. People know me by reputation from my local government office. And so we believe that we were able to make a difference and help elect a good Republican in every way who is also good on the environment. And then he, of course, went on to win the election and is now in Congress. We only endorsed out of the, I believe there are 435 congressmen up every year, and there are about 35, 33 senators. Of that, that adds up to about 470 election races that were on last fall. We only endorsed 23 people. But the people that we endorsed were people like Mark Kirk, who are credible Republicans with credible positions on the environment. And we believe that that is where the future is for us, that in Republican primaries, we will help people pick a Republican who also shares a strong conservation ethic. And we are not going to get involved in telling them to vote, you know, in any way, but we do get involved in Republican primaries. We don't take positions telling them to vote for or against this Democrat or that Republican, but in Republican primaries, we believe we can make a difference.
We're getting short on time. You know, there's one thing that I said in talking about the program we were going to do, and I actually haven't gotten to ask you about, and I think we ought at least devote a couple of minutes to this, and that is the logging issue. Just before President Clinton left office, he signed an executive order that would ban logging and new
road building
in National Forest. Here we're talking about 58.5 million acres, so it's a lot of territory. What it means is the order bans commercial logging, mining, road building, oil and gas development, and that then when the Bush administration came in, a lot of these things that the former president had done before he left, they put a hold on these, and the question is now what's going to happen to this?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think will happen to this?
Well, just let me tell you that we supported the Roadless Initiative. They worked very hard for it last year, all through the year, and I'd like to just make a few points about that. The areas that were declared roadless, where new roads could not be built, were places where there are no roads, so they are de facto wilderness areas. So in a sense, what Clinton was trying to do was to protect areas that are currently and have always been wilderness, as wilderness. The national forests are riddled with roads already. There's something like 500,000 miles of roads in our national forests already, more than our national interstate highway system. And the backlog of money that it would take to keep them in good repair is astounding. And the fact is that they're not in good repair. They are falling apart. They are creating erosion problems. They are creating watershed problems. We don't even have the money to keep up the roads that we currently have in our national forests that are used by the logging trucks. So why should we go in and build new ones when we can't even keep the ones up that we have? We did support that both from an environmental position and from an economic position. This is another form of subsidy. I talked about the cattleman's ranching subsidy. This is another subsidy that people aren't aware of. The American people own the land. We own those forests. We pay, we buy, or we build the roads. We, the taxpayers, build the roads that the logging companies use to go into our national forests and cut down our trees at a highly subsidized rate. And we don't get anything back into the Treasury for allowing them into our forests, for building the roads for them, for maintaining the roads for them. But that is a corporate subsidy that the industry, the logging industry, has lived on for such a long time and insists on it. And unfortunately, President Bush is quite closely allied with them. He spent an hour with, I think, about a dozen executives from the timber companies last year. This was reported in the Oregon, in the Oregonian newspaper. He spent an hour with them, came out with $1.5 million, and has been very strongly supportive of logging in our national forests. all President Clinton was trying to do in that case was just protect what is in fact already wilderness.
Well,
protect the public's assets.
You know, I'm sorry to say we've come to the end
That's
of the time,
okay.
And we're going to have to stop. I do appreciate you taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And we'll again tell people if you're interested in finding out more about this organization, Republicans for Environmental Protection, they do have that website, www.rep.org. Our guest, Martha Marks, the president. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.